Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. Now I'd like to start another angle on debt, investigating it from a different perspective and focusing on how there have been programs and systems to actually generate debt on a global level for the benefit of corporations and governments. I'm going to go into a New York Times bestseller by John Perkins, his first book called Confessions of an Economic Hitman. In the riveting story of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, John Perkins tells his own inner journey from willing servant of empire to impassioned advocate for the rights of oppressed people. Covertly recruited by the United States National Security Agency and on the payroll of an international consulting firm, he traveled the world to Indonesia, Panama, Ecuador, Colombia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and other strategically important countries. His job was to implement policies that promoted the interests of the U.S. corporatocracy, which is a coalition of government, banks, and corporations, while professing to alleviate poverty, policies that alienated many nations and ultimately led to September 11th and growing anti-Americanism. Perkins' story illuminates just how far he and his colleagues, self-described as economic hitmen, were willing to go. He explains, for instance, how he helped to implement a secret scheme that funneled billions of Saudi Arabian petrodollars back into the U.S. economy and that further cemented the intimate relationship between the Islamic fundamentalist House of Saud and a succession of American administrations. Perkins reveals the hidden mechanics of imperial control behind some of the most dramatic events in recent history, such as the fall of the Shah of Iran, the death of Panamanian President Omar Torrijos, and the U.S. invasions of Panama and Iraq. By the way, this book was published in 2004. The book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which many people warned Perkins not to write, exposes the little-known inner workings of a system that fosters globalization and leads to the impoverishment of millions of people across the planet. It is a compelling story that also offers hope and a vision for realizing the American dream of a just and compassionate world that will bring us greater security. And I highly recommend that anyone who finds what I'm going to go through interesting should go and get the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Quito, Ecuador's capital, stretches across a volcanic valley high in the Andes at an altitude of 9,000 feet. Residents of this city, which was founded long before Columbus arrived in the Americas, are accustomed to seeing snow on the surrounding peaks, despite the fact that they live just a few miles south of the equator. The city of Shell, a frontier outpost and military base hacked out of Ecuador's Amazon jungle to serve the oil company, whose name it bears, is nearly 8,000 feet lower than Quito. A steaming city, it is inhabited mostly by soldiers, oil workers, and the indigenous people from the Shuar and Quechua tribes who work for them as prostitutes and laborers. To journey from one city to another, you must travel a road that is both tortuous and breathtaking. Local people will tell you that during the trip, you experience all four seasons in a single day. Although John Perkins had driven that road many times, he never felt tired of the spectacular scenery. Sheer cliffs, punctuated by cascading waterfalls and brilliant bromeliads, rise up one side. On the other side, the earth drops abruptly into a deep abyss where the Pastaza River, a headwater of the Amazon, snakes its way down the Andes. The Pastaza carries water from the glaciers of Cotopaxi, one of the world's highest active volcanoes, and a deity in the time of the Incas, to the Atlantic Ocean over 3,000 miles away. In 2003, John departed Quito in a Subaru Outback and headed for Shell on a mission that was like no other he had ever accepted. He was hoping to end a war he had helped create. As is the case with so many things EHMs must take responsibility for, it is a war that is virtually unknown anywhere outside the country where it is fought. He was on his way to meet with the Shuars and Quechuas and their neighbors, the Achuars, the Zaparos, and the Shiwiars tribes, determined to prevent oil companies from destroying their homes, families, and lands, even if it means they must die in the process. For them, it is a war about the survival of their children and cultures, while for the companies, it is about power, money, and natural resources. It is one part of the struggle for world domination and the dream of a few greedy men, a global empire. That is what EHMs do best, build a global empire. They are an elite group of men and women who utilize international financial organizations to foment conditions that make other nations subservient to the corporatocracy running our biggest corporations, our government, and our banks. Like our counterparts in the mafia, EHMs provide favors. These take the form of loans to develop infrastructure, electric generating plants, highways, ports, airports, or industrial parks. A condition of such loans is that engineering and construction companies from our own country must build all these projects. In essence, most of the money never leaves the United States. It is simply transferred from banking offices in Washington to engineering offices in New York, Houston, or San Francisco. Despite the fact that the money is returned almost immediately to corporations that are members of the corporatocracy, the creditor, the recipient country is required to pay it all back, principal plus interest. If an EHM is completely successful, the loans are so large that the debtor is forced to default on its payments after a few years. When this happens, then like the mafia, there is a demand for a pound of flesh. This often includes one or more of the following: control over United Nations votes, the installation of military bases, or access to precious resources such as oil or the Panama Canal. Of course, the debtor still owes the money, and another country is added to the global empire. I want to take a moment for a station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now back to the story. Driving from Quito towards Shell on the sunny day in 2003, He thought back 35 years to the first time he arrived in this part of the world. He had read that although Ecuador is only about the size of Nevada, it has more than 30 active volcanoes, over 15% of the world's bird species, and thousands of as yet unclassified plants, and that it is a land of diverse cultures where nearly as many people speak ancient indigenous languages as speak Spanish. He found it fascinating and certainly exotic. Yet the words that kept coming to his mind at that time were pure, untouched, and innocent. Much had changed in 35 years. At the time of his first visit in 1968, Texaco had only just discovered petroleum in Ecuador's Amazon region. Today, oil accounts for nearly half the country's exports. A trans-Andean pipeline built shortly after his first visit has since leaked over a 500,000 barrels of oil into the fragile rainforest, more than twice the amount spilled by the Exxon Valdez. Today, a new $1.3 billion 300-mile pipeline constructed by an EHM-organized consortium promises to make Ecuador one of the world's top 10 suppliers of oil to the United States. Vast areas of rainforest have fallen, macaws and jaguars have all but vanished, three Ecuadorian indigenous cultures have been driven to the verge of collapse, and pristine rivers have been transformed into flaming cesspools. During that same period, the indigenous cultures began fighting back. For instance, on May 7, 2003, a group of American lawyers representing more than 30,000 indigenous Ecuadorian people filed a $1 billion lawsuit against Chevron Texaco Corp. The suit asserts that between 1971 and 1992, the oil giant dumped into open holes in rivers over 4 million gallons per day of toxic wastewater contaminated with oil, heavy metals, carcinogens, and that the company left behind nearly 350 uncovered waste pits that continue to kill both people and animals. Outside the window of John's Outback, great clouds of mist rolled in from the forest and up the Pastaza's canyons. Sweat soaked his shirt, and his stomach began to churn, but not just from the intense tropical heat and the serpentine twists in the road. Knowing the part he played in destroying this beautiful country was once again taking its toll. Because of the EHMs, Ecuador is in far worse shape today than she was before she was introduced to the miracles of the modern economics, banking, and engineering. Since 1970, during this period known euphemistically as the oil boom, the official poverty level grew from 50 to 70%, under or unemployment increased from 15 to 70%, and public debt increased from $240 million to $16 billion. Meanwhile, the share of natural resources allocated to the poorest segments of the population declined from 20% to 6%. Unfortunately, Ecuador is not the exception. Nearly every country EHMs have brought under the global empire's umbrella have suffered a similar fate. Third world debt has grown to more than $2.5 trillion, and the cost of servicing it, over $375 billion per year, as of 2004, is more than all third world spending on health and education, and 20 times what developing countries receive annually in foreign aid. Over half the people in the world survive on less than $2 per day, which is roughly the same amount they received in the early 1970s. Meanwhile, the top 1% of third world household accounts for 70 to 90% of all private financial wealth and real estate ownership in their country. The actual percentage depends on the specific country. The Subaru slowed as it meandered through the streets of the beautiful resort town of Baños, famous for the hot baths created by the underground volcanic rivers that flow from the highly active Mount Tungurahua. Children run along beside the vehicle, waving and trying to sell gum and cookies. Then they left Baños behind. The spectacular scenery ended abruptly as the Subaru sped out of paradise and into the modern vision of Dante's Inferno. A gigantic monster reared up from the river, a mammoth gray wall. Its dripping concrete was totally out of place, completely unnatural and incompatible with the landscape. Of course, seeing it there did not surprise him. He knew all along that it would be waiting in ambush. He had encountered it many times before, and in the past had praised it as the symbol of EHM accomplishments. Even so, it made his skin crawl. That hideous, incongruous wall is a dam that blocks the rushing Pastaza River, diverts its water through huge tunnels bored into the mountain, and converts the energy to electricity. This is the 156 megawatt Agoyan hydroelectric project. It fuels the industries that make a handful of Ecuadorian families wealthy, and it has been the source of untold suffering for the farmers and indigenous people who live along the river. This hydroelectric plant is just one of the many projects developed through the efforts of EHMs. Such projects are the reason Ecuador is now a member of the global empire, and the reason why the Shuars and Quichuas and their neighbors threaten war against oil companies. Because of EHM projects, Ecuador is awash in foreign debt and must devote an inordinate share of its national budget to paying this off, instead of using its capital to help the millions of its citizens officially classified as dangerously impoverished. The only way Ecuador can buy down its foreign obligations is by selling its rainforests to the oil companies. Indeed, one of the reasons the EHMs set their sights on Ecuador in the first place was because the sea of oil beneath its Amazon region is believed to rival the oil fields of the Middle East. The global empire demands its pound of flesh in the form of oil concessions. These demands became especially urgent after September 11, 2001, when Washington feared that Middle Eastern supplies might cease. On top of that, Venezuela, the U.S. third largest oil supplier, had recently elected a populist president, Hugo Chavez, who took a strong stand against what he referred to as U.S. imperialism. He threatened to cut off oil sales to the United States. The EHMs had failed in Iraq and Venezuela, but had succeeded in Ecuador. Now it could be milked for all its worth. Ecuador is typical of countries around the world that EHMs have brought into the economic political fold. For every $100 of crude taken out of the Ecuadorian rainforest, the oil companies receive $75. Of the remaining $25, three-quarters must go to paying off the foreign debt. Most of the remainder covers military and other government expenses, which leaves about $2.50 for health, education, and programs aimed at helping the poor. Thus, out of every $100 worth of oil torn from the Amazon, less than $3 goes to the people who need the money most, those whose lives have been so adversely impacted by the dams, the drilling, and the pipelines, and who are dying from the lack of edible food and potable water. All of those people, millions in Ecuador, billions around the planet, are potential terrorists. Not because they believe in communism or anarchism or are intrinsically evil, but simply because they are desperate. Looking at the dam, he wondered when these people would take action, like the Americans against England in the 1770s, or Latin Americans against Spain in the early 1800s. And I'll continue in a moment. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The subtlety of this modern empire building puts the Roman centurions, the Spanish conquistadors, and the 18th and 19th century European colonial powers to shame. Economic hitmen are crafty. They learned from history. Today, they do not carry swords. They do not wear armor or clothes that set them apart. In countries like Ecuador, Nigeria, and Indonesia, They dress like local school teachers and shop owners. In Washington and Paris, they look like government bureaucrats and bankers. They appear humble, normal. They visit project sites and stroll through impoverished villages. They profess altruism, talk with local papers about the wonderful humanitarian things they are doing. They cover the conference tables of government committees with spreadsheets and financial projections, and they lecture at the Harvard Business School about the miracles of macroeconomics. They are on the record, in the open, or so they portray themselves and so are accepted. It is how the system works. They seldom resort to anything illegal because the system itself is built on subterfuge and the system is by definition legitimate. However, and this is a very large caveat, if they fail, an even more sinister breed steps in, ones the EHMs refer to as the Jackals, men who trace their heritage directly to those earlier empires. The Jackals are always there, lurking in the shadows. When they emerge, heads of state are overthrown or die in violent accidents. And if, by chance, the Jackals fail, as they failed in Afghanistan and Iraq, then the old models resurface. When the Jackals fail, young Americans are sent in to kill and to die. As Perkins passed the monster, that hulking mammoth wall of gray concrete rising from the river, he was very conscious of the sweat that soaked his clothes and of the tightening in his intestines. He headed on down into the jungle to meet with the indigenous people who are determined to fight to the last man in order to stop this empire he helped create, and he was overwhelmed with the feelings of guilt. He asked himself, how did a nice kid from rural New Hampshire ever get into such dirty business? Now we'll look at the first part of his story from 1963 to 1971, in which he is developed as an EHM, an economic hitman. He says it began innocently enough. He was an only child, born into the middle class in 1945. Both his parents came from three centuries of New England Yankee stock. Their strict, moralistic, staunchly Republican attitudes reflected generations of puritanical ancestors. They were the first in their families to attend college on scholarships. His mother became a high school Latin teacher. His father joined World War II as a Navy lieutenant and was in charge of the armed guard gun crew on a highly flammable merchant marine tanker in the Atlantic. When John was born in Hanover, New Hampshire, his father was recuperating from a broken hip in a Texas hospital. John did not see him until he was a year old. John's father took a job teaching languages at Tilton School, a boys' boarding school in rural New Hampshire. The campus stood high on a hill, proudly, some would say arrogantly, towering over the town of the same name. This exclusive institution limited its enrollment to about 50 students in each grade level, 9 through 12. The students were mostly the scions of wealthy families from Buenos Aires, Caracas, Boston, and New York. John's family was cash-starved. However, they most certainly did not see themselves as poor. Although the school's teachers received very little salary, all of their needs were provided free. Food, housing, heat, water, and the workers who mowed their lawns and shoveled their snow. Beginning on his fourth birthday, he ate in prep school dining, shagged balls for the soccer teams his dad coached, and handed out towels in the locker room. It is an understatement to say that the teachers and their wives felt superior to the locals. He used to hear his parents joking about being the lords of the manor, ruling over the lowly peasants, the townies. He knew it was more than a joke. John's elementary and middle school friends belonged to that peasant class. They were very poor. Their parents were dirt farmers, lumberjacks, and mill workers. They resented the preppies on the hill, and in turn, John's father and mother discouraged him from socializing with townie girls, who they called tarts and sluts. He had shared school books and crayons with these girls since first grade, and over the years he fell in love with three of them, Anne, Priscilla, and Judy. He had a hard time understanding his parents' perspective, however, he deferred to their wishes. Every year, they would spend the last 3 months of his dad's summer vacation at a lake cottage built by his grandfather in 1921. It was surrounded by forests, and at night, they could hear owls and mountain lions. They had no neighbors. He was the only child within walking distance. In the early years, he passed the days by pretending that the trees were knights of the round table and damsels in distress named Anne, Priscilla, or Judy, depending on the year. At 14, he received free tuition to Tilton School. With his parents prodding, he rejected everything to do with the town and never saw his old friends again. When his new classmates went home to their mansions and penthouses for vacation, he remained alone on the hill. Their girlfriends were debutantes. John had no girlfriends. All the girls he knew were sluts. He had cast them off, and they had forgotten him. He was alone and terribly frustrated. John's parents were masters at manipulation. They assured him that he was privileged to have such an opportunity and that someday he would be grateful. He would find the perfect wife, one suited to their high moral standards. Inside, though, he seethed. He craved female companionship. The idea of a slut was most alluring. However, rather than rebelling, he repressed his rage and expressed his frustration by excelling. He was an honor student, captain of 2 varsity teams, editor of the school newspaper. He was determined to show up his rich classmates and to leave Tilton behind forever. During his senior year, he was awarded a full athletic scholarship to Brown and an academic scholarship to Middlebury. He chose Brown mainly because he preferred being an athlete and because it was located in a city. His mother had graduated from Middlebury and his father had received his master's degree there, so even though Brown was in the Ivy League, they preferred Middlebury. "What if you break your leg?" his father asked. "Better to take the academic scholarship." He buckled. Middlebury was, in his perception, merely an inflated version of Tilton, albeit in rural Vermont instead of rural New Hampshire. True, it was co-ed, but he was poor and most everyone else was wealthy, and he had not attended school with a female in 4 years. He lacked confidence, felt outclassed, was miserable. He pleaded with his dad to let him drop out or to take a year off. He wanted to move to Boston and learn about life and women. His father would not hear of it. "How can I pretend to prepare other parents' kids for college if my own won't stay in one?" was the response. John had come to understand that life is composed of a series of coincidences. How we react to these, how we exercise what some refer to as free will, is everything. The choices we make within the boundaries of the twists of fate determine who we are. 2 major coincidences came that shaped his life occurred at Middlebury. One came in the form of an Iranian, the son of a general who was a personal advisor to the Shah, and the other was a beautiful young woman named Anne, like his childhood sweetheart. And we will continue in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt-manageable life.